report by Dr. Dan Burton, his congressional report. If you get the Southwood report, you can get the Dan Burton's report to Congress. All of this suppressed by the media. Why? Because there really are people who want to hurt your children. Remember Dr. Mengele, the angel of death over in Germany? Did you know, of course, that the CIA had helped him to escape to South America where he lived out his life? Why would they have done something like that? Because there's a dark side of the CIA. And of course, you need to get our four tapes out on Operation Paperclip and how we helped the Germans, the Nazis come to America and South America. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. We're involved in a spiritual battle. Please pray for Radio Liberty. Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming at you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grigg, as it always is here on Friday evening, the second hour. Good evening, William. How are you?
Dr. Stan, it's always a pleasure to be with you. I'm doing great, and I'm excited to talk with you this evening.
Well, tell us, what are we going to be talking about tonight?
There are a couple of things I want to talk about that don't seem to be directly related, but have to do with this overarching picture of how people, as you constantly remind us, are being deliberately and very carefully deceived about what's really going on in the world. And the first way I'd like to illustrate that point would be by resisting some of the permutations and background of the recent incident with the Gaza flotilla there, which was, of course, a flotilla of ships headed for Gaza, which is under a security cordon enforced by the Israeli government. These ships were flying the flag of Turkey, and they were boarded by Israeli commandos, and a lot of ugliness ensued. 9 people were killed, including a U.S. citizen, 19-year-old American-born dual national who lives in Turkey but was born in upstate New York. There are a couple of things about this incident in the background that I think are very important for people to remember. The most important thing, I think, in terms of understanding what's going on with the blockade of Gaza and the Hamas domination of that enclave, it's about 1.5 million people living in an area that's not much bigger than the little town in Idaho where I live. And you've got a dual blockade. The Egyptians are blockading and the Israelis are blockading, although just last week the Egyptians said that they were going to be reconsidering the wisdom of the blockade. And there are tunnels which have been built beneath the security barrier between Egypt and Gaza, and so there is a black market supplying the needs of the Gazans. But Gaza is under the domination of Hamas, and Hamas, the so-called Islamic Resistance, is a group that was created with the collaboration of the Israeli intelligence agencies in 1987 under the direction of the CIA. Hamas is an outgrowth of the Muslim Brotherhood, which for over 60 years, although to a certain extent today, this is not necessarily the case, that there's operational relationships between the Muslim Brotherhood and the CIA, but for the first 20 or 30 years of its existence, the Muslim Brotherhood was sponsored and funded and promoted by the CIA. And the Muslim Brotherhood, as we pointed out before, is an organization that's sort of the taproot of all these really radical jihadist groups, anti-American, anti-Western orientation. It's where Al-Qaeda came from. It's where most of the suicide bombers have been recruited and trained is either through the Islamic Brotherhood or through groups which are outgrowths of it. Hamas is a tendril of the Muslim Brotherhood, and so in a very real sense, you're dealing with a group that was, if you will, sort of a stepchild of the CIA, and it was midwifed by the Shin Bet Security Service in Israel back in 1987, supposedly to be a counterweight to Fatah, which was the political wing of the so-called Palestinian Liberation Organization, which was run by the late and thoroughly unlamented Marxist sexual deviant by the name of Yasser Arafat.
Let me just intercede for just a moment. Of course, you point out that it was the CIA and the Mossad who created Hamas, this terrible organization. It is a terrible organization. There's a book out there called Son of Hamas, and it's written by a young man whose father was a Palestinian, his father was the head of Hamas. And, of course, the young man eventually became a Christian. But but in this book, at one point, he asks his father, who's the head of all the Hamas and then in Palestine there, and he says, who really is running this? I mean, you're the figurative head, but who's really in charge of it? And his father, who runs Hamas, said, I really don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, they're over in Syria, I think. They have lots of money, but they never give me any of it. Yeah. I'm the figurehead, but somebody else really runs it. And we'll be right back. Go right ahead.
That's, of course, a very important thing, because you point out this is the guy who was the son of one of the founders of Hamas, and this founding member of Hamas, who was later killed by a so-called targeted assassination carried out by Israeli intelligence. That founder didn't know who was responsible for Hamas and who was actually running the organization. That's a principle of strategic confusion that Arafat benefited from. At one point in, I think it was probably the late 1990s, As recently as 2006, 2007, there were 14 separate secret police organizations being run by Fatah, which is the other wing of the Palestinian radical movement in Palestine. 14 separate intelligence services. Back in 1997, when I attended a counterterrorism conference at the University of Illinois, Chicago, that was co-sponsored by the Justice Department and the State Department, and also by, of course, that university, there was a presentation that was made by an ATF official by the name of Kathleen Kiernan. Very sharp young woman, youngish woman. She's about the age I am now, in her mid-40s. And the very first slide of her PowerPoint presentation showed her in Palestine next to Yasser Arafat talking about how the ATF was working to train and equip Arafat's intelligence agencies. And this is a really important thing, because just that week, I mean, literally days before that conference took place in Chicago, there had been a marketplace bombing in Jerusalem that had killed probably several dozen Israelis. You had one of these routine and no less horrifying for being routine spectacles of dead Israelis and wounded Israelis, blinded young people on the streets of an Israeli city. And I'm sitting there in the audience, and surrounded by law enforcement and intelligence personnel, people who are first responders. And you have this ATF official bragging about how she's doing her part for world peace by helping the ATF to train Yasser Arafat's intelligence services, of which there were no fewer than a half dozen at the time. And the reason why there were so many, I believe, is in order to keep them divided and keep them conquered, to make sure that nobody knows who's exactly in charge here. There's a book I keep referring to that really made an impression on me by Richard Ben Kramer. His book is called How Israel Lost, and Mr. Kramer spends about half of every year over in the Middle East. He spent a great deal of time talking not only to Israelis in the settlements, but also Palestinians, and he actually had a chance to speak with Yasser Arafat at some length before he died, that is to say, before Arafat died. And the portrait he depicts of Arafat is really quite interesting. When Arafat would get up in the morning, from probably 8 o'clock in the morning until late in the afternoon or even into the evening.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's William Craig, and he's talking about a book called How Israel Lost, and certainly the author had had an opportunity to get to meet Arafat. He talked, of course, the Israelis. He talked to the Palestinians, but he'd got to know a fair amount about Arafat, and William was just saying that every morning, Yasser Arafat, what was this all about?
He'd get up in the morning, and from 8 in the morning until he got a break, he would be doing nothing but writing checks. And he was writing checks in order to bribe people. He was distributing the largesse he was receiving from the United Nations Relief Works Agency, UNRWA, as it's referred to, the acronym sort of an awkward one, or from the European Union, or from the State Department, or from the Agency for International Development. He had tens of millions, even at one point, hundreds of millions of dollars to play with. And all he would do all day long, at least while he was in the presence of somebody who was not under his control, would be to make these checks and make these disbursements to bribe people. And the reason why he did this, of course, was in order to keep his retinue of cutthroats and thieves on his side. He was the guy who basically had signature authority over all the money, and that's what kept him in charge. Well, where did the money come from? Most of it, and by most I mean, you know, 65-75% or more, came from United States taxpayers. In other words, we were keeping him in power, and he stayed in power because he was able to bribe people. And without his signature, without that recognized signature on those checks, there's no way that he would have lasted longer than a millisecond. Well, the same equation holds true today. U.S. aid equals security for whoever the ruling thug is among the Palestinians. And that's true for Hamas. That's true for the faction that is running the West Bank. Hamas was put into power through democratic elections in Gaza. And what happened is that after they had obtained a plurality, the Bush administration back in 2006, subcontracting through the most ruthless and blood-stained Hamas terrorists they could find, arranged for a civil war in Gaza that lasted a few weeks. And at the end of it, Hamas had insulated itself in power. It had entrenched itself even more deeply. And so he ended up in a situation where there were literally millions upon millions of rounds of ammunition, as well as high-caliber weaponry and grenade launchers and explosives and all kinds of ordnance that were permitted through the blockade of Gaza, through the security checkpoints in Gaza. The blockade wasn't enforced back then. That's a bit of an anachronism. The Israelis were willing to allow all of this ordnance, of these armaments, to pass through into Gaza, into the hands of Arafat's faction of the PLO. Arafat was gone by then. I believe Mr. Abbas was in power by this point. But the point is that the Israelis permitted all that weaponry to go into Gaza on the assumption that Arafat, the faction that had been run by Arafat before his death, would be rolling up the Hamas network, which had been created with the Israeli intelligence service itself back in 1987. Well, the war didn't turn out the way that most people expected, or maybe it did. Who knows what the game was, whether this is something that was a result of a bad calculation by the Bush administration, or whether the outcome that this apparently adverse outcome was what was intended. But you ended up with Hamas in power, with the Fatah faction routed, and Hamas in charge of a huge arsenal of weaponry that had been provided to them by the United States with the help of the Israelis. And as a result, now you have a situation where intermittently there are attacks made by Hamas into Israel, and there are retaliatory military strikes against the Gazans by the Israelis that do little, if anything, to attrit the capacity of Hamas to wage asymmetrical terrorist warfare against Israel, but a great deal to immiserate the common people in Gaza. And now you've got this blockade, which is a really weird and sort of whimsical exercise, where in addition to building materials, cement, and other things that might be actual dual-use goods that could be applied for military purposes, you have a blockade that also bans children's toys and a whole list of foodstuffs that are very commonplace. And the roster of banned items changes from time to time. But the Gazans are pretty much at the mercy of a government that was installed with the help of the United States and the Israelis. And they're suffering now under an economic blockade that's doing nothing but fortifying the position of the Hamas group within Gaza, because anytime you blockade a population, anytime you cut off trade, you make them more dependent on the government that rules them. That's what happened with Saddam Hussein between 1991 and 2003. You had this insane embargo against Iraq that did nothing but fortify Saddam Hussein's position while killing through hunger and sickness and all kinds of avoidable problems, innocent people all around him. It made him, as any dictator longs to be, it made him all the more powerful because he was in charge of an economy based on scarcity. He got the same thing going on with Hamas right now. And just within the last day or so, forgive me, McClatchy News Service, which is one of the few wire services that actually does journalism of first instance, they really do Pulitzer-worthy work, McClatchy News Service unearthed an Israeli memo admitting that the blockade was not a security measure. The blockade was a form of economic warfare against the Gazans rather than being a security measure. And by way of fortifying this point even further, there was this speech that was given a couple of days ago by Senator Charles Schumer of New York, who's probably one of my least favorite politicians, and that's saying something because there are not many people in that population for whom I have any respect at all, in which he talked about the Gaza blockade. And he said, really, the purpose here is to strangle them economically. It's not to protect the Israelis, in other words. It's to sow and cultivate misery among the Gazans. And that's, of course, an ideal environment in which terrorism and the resentments that fuel terrorism can flourish. And so really, that's the backstory to this little drama that played out on the Mediterranean a couple of weeks ago. And one of the things that we should recognize about the way that that event unfolded is that it really didn't work to the benefit of the Israelis. It was a really good example of blowback, at least in terms of PR. Apart from public opinion here in the United States, there's a pretty uniform animus toward Israel that has been created in reaction to this event, whether right or wrong, whether good or bad, whether what they did was benevolent or evil. The fact is that it is an unambiguous PR defeat for the Israelis.
Well, wait a minute, I was
believe that it was done for that reason.
Well, basically, you know, we've analyzed this with a fellow named Barry Shamish, who's a Jewish Israeli patriot, and he just feels that this was done intentionally to discredit the Israelis. I mean, he said, you know, what a ridiculous thing to have done to send them down there. There are lots of other ways to have stopped the ship. Why would you send your sailors or your Marines down there the way that you did? You knew it was going to happen. They're not that stupid, and yet they did it, so obviously it was done already to discredit Israel, and they've succeeded very well because it was probably done under the auspices of a man named Barak, who is the defense minister, who of course has a long history of let's put it this way, he never does what's right for Israel, but you go right ahead.
We're talking about Ehud Barak, the former prime minister and a very dubious figure within their defense ministry. Yeah, I was going to mention Barry Shamish's analysis of this, because I think he makes some very compelling points here. One of the things that I read in a piece by Leon Wieseltier of the New Republic that I thought was really interesting, I actually worked at the New Republic a couple of decades ago as an intern, and I made that choice because I wanted to be exposed to points of view that I wasn't usually exposed to. I wanted to be around people who had different opinions and different takes on international affairs than my own. And boy, the New Republic certainly supplied that in abundance. Mr. Wieseltier is a defender of the Israeli government, Israel in general, and his take was that they really should have called this operation, the interception of the flotilla, Operation Make the World Hate Us, because that was the obvious and ineluctable outcome of what they had done. And he got that phrase in a conversation with somebody who's a veteran of the Israeli security community. He said, well, if we sat out for the express purpose of doing something that would fortify the resentment that the so-called international community has toward Israel, we could have calibrated our actions more perfectly to that outcome than what we did. Usually when you're dealing with people who are intelligent, and say what you will about the Israeli government or governments in general, but the Israeli government in particular, there are many things you can say about them, many characterizations you can employ, but the word stupid doesn't appear on that list. And so obviously you've got something that doesn't redound to their benefit in any way, shape, or form. And I think that it's important to get that kind of a reality check when you're dealing with international affairs of this sort. Dr. Stan, I wanted to roll back the tape a little bit, if you will, and talk a little bit more about the background to the Muslim Brotherhood.
You go right ahead. I think that's so important.
Yeah, you mentioned this new book by the son of one of the founders of Hamas. There are a number of books that have come out recently that go into detail about the background of the Muslim Brotherhood and its relationship with U.S. intelligence. And one of them that you mentioned before is Dreyfus's book, I believe it's called The Devil's Bargain.
The Devil's Game. Carry that book, and we would recommend it to everybody. The Devil's Game by Dreyfus. Go ahead.
That's a very important book. And there's another really recent book published by a fellow by the name of Ian Johnson, who writes for the Wall Street Journal, entitled A Mosque in Munich. And he tells the same story that Dreyfus tells from a vastly different ideological perspective. And that's a useful thing, because if you're dealing with somebody who comes from a different vector, you get depth perception of the story, and you sort of control for ideological bias. As a matter of fact, the story that Ian Johnson tells in this book, A Mosque in Munich, is even more shocking in some ways than the version that Dreyfus provides. And the thing that people have to understand is that the threat we're dealing with right now was cultivated by the people who were supposedly protecting us from it. The old game of creating the poison and the antidote in the same laboratory.
In essence, what this is all about is that the CIA and MI6, intelligence agency, created the best enemy money could buy. We call it Al-Qaeda, we call it the Muslim Brotherhood, we call it Hamas. In fact, some people even think perhaps we created the mullahs there in Iran. Go right ahead.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, there's a book by Stephen Kinsey.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that will protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances? Even things which can cause sickness or disease. If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Berkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Berkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
The radical Muslims during the Second World War, and how the CIA and the intelligence agencies thought, see, wouldn't it be wonderful, we'll just go ahead and try to build up this radical form of Islam. Oh, we can use that if we just create this whole radical Islamic movement, that same Islamic movement that is today killing American boys in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. But go right ahead.
You know, the story really isn't just confined, as both of us know and both of us have pointed out before, to the way that the Soviet Union cultivated radical groups within the Islamic tradition and the worst and most envenomed opponents of the West to fight the Soviets, or the way that the Nazis did the same thing. Of course, as Anthony Sutton has documented, the same Wall Street interests that we're dealing with today were instrumental in the rise of the Soviet dictatorship and in the rise of Adolf Hitler. They armed and financed Hitler. And they armed and financed the Soviet Union, and then in order to defeat the threat of the Axis, they allied with the Soviet Union in World War II, thereby putting us into an alliance with history's greatest mass murderer in order to contain and defeat a threat posed by a lesser but still ghastly mass murderer in the regime of in Adolf Hitler and his regime. And then after World War II, you had another conflict arranged with the Soviet Union, and suddenly you're dealing with people who are veterans of the Nazi propaganda and intelligence apparatus, even in the Muslim world, to fight, supposedly, the forces of communism. And then once the Soviet Union undergoes a supposed collapse, if you will, a Potemkin collapse, now we find ourselves fighting against insurgent Islam. And the people we're fighting against now, of course, are the same people who are being cultivated a half century ago by the CIA to fight the most recent enemy of the week, and that was the Soviet Union. And now we find ourselves in bed with Soviet-sponsored elements in fighting CIA-sponsored elements of the Islamic network. Now, what Johnson points out in this book, A Mosque in Munich, is the following. America continues to support groups such as the Muslim Brotherhood. There are two Muslim Brotherhoods, he argues, one in the West and another in the rest of the world. The former is much more perilous to American interests. Still, out of ignorance and laziness in part, many American bureaucrats and foreign policymakers turn to the best-looking, business-suited Islamist leaders as allies. Many are tied to the Muslim Brotherhood, which, in the West, is a deliberate proponent of radical Islam. The United States does this in part because it's easier to turn to self-appointed spokesmen for the world's Muslims than to reach out to far less media-savvy members of civil society, Muslim groups that aren't so slick and organized by ordinary people. Now, the reviewer here, and I think Johnson in this book, are engaging in a very important and tragic error. They're assuming the best motives on the part of the people who are running the policy. They're assuming that we're dealing with ignorance, stupidity, or laziness, and I think that those three things in combination can only explain so much, because quite frankly, there aren't that many really stupid people who find themselves in policy-making positions that exalted. To continue with the review, the book is funny and tragic and peaks toward the end when Johnson takes us along on his interviews with contemporary members of the European branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. One day in Cologne, Johnson rides along in the BMW's passenger seat of Ibrahim El Zayat, a young Islamist who leads many of Germany's Muslims. Zayat is hugely controversial, and it's hard to know whether or not he condones the use of violence based on some of his murky associations. When Johnson points this out, Zayat points right back at Johnson. A lot of people say that Ian Johnson is a CIA agent because you write so little. My boss says that too, I say. You should write more. Sloth is a sin. At the end of the ride, Zayat answers one of the most important riddles as to why the West gets it wrong when choosing Islamic allies. We ask the wrong questions about who they are and where they get their ideas from. And then he goes on to explain that this is a persistent error that's been going on since the 1950s when the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood was being actively courted by the State Department and by the CIA and by the Carnegie Endowment and by that entire constellation of familiar and I would consider insidious forces within the federal government. But once again, an error persisted in after a certain point is a policy. It's not an error. I mean, once these things have been redundantly exposed and people choose them anyway, we're not dealing with errors here. We're dealing with deliberate policy choices, and the consequences must be chosen as well. And so you've got all these sources from all these different points on the political compass validating what we've been saying, which is that the enemy we're fighting right now is a creation, once again, of the same government that supposedly is protecting us from that threat. And that's the way that governments historically have gone about ensuring that they have populations that are controlled and compliant.
And Chris, these are the same sort of things that Machiavelli talked about in The Prince. You know, you wanted an enemy. And what we're really talking about is the best enemy that American tax dollars can buy. You have to have an enemy to rally the people behind our leaders, because our leaders are going to protect us from the wicked Osama bin Laden, who's over there in a cave. Or is he in Iran? Anyway, he's plotting, all the time plotting, to take away our freedom. That's why they've got to increase monitoring all of us. Well, William, you go right ahead.
Well, there's an ominous report tonight in the Times of London saying that Saudi Arabia has given Israel given Israel clearance to attack suspected Iranian nuclear sites. The lead runs as follows. Saudi Arabia has conducted tests to stand down its air defenses to enable Israeli jets to make a bombing raid on Iran's nuclear facilities. The week that the UN Security Council imposed a new round of sanctions on Tehran, defense sources in the Gulf say that Riyadh has agreed to allow Israel to use a narrow corridor of its airspace in the north of the country to shorten the distance for a bombing run on Iran. To ensure the Israeli bombers pass unmolested, Riyadh has carried out tests to make certain its own jets are not scrambled and missile defense systems are not activated. Once the Israelis are through, the kingdom's air defenses will return to full alert. If that's true, and it's interesting that, assuming this is true, that it managed to make it into the international press, then it would appear that at some point in the not terribly distant future, we're going to see the rollout of the long-anticipated and long-delayed attack on Iran, and as a result, we're going to see the entire energy-based industrial economy of the world go right into a deep, flat spin.
Well, let me tell you that certainly Jerome Corsi, Dr. Corsi, and I know you're acquainted with him, he was invited to go over to Israel about a year and a half ago, and he came back and he wrote a book called Why Israel Can't Wait. He talked to the premier, the president, the chief of the defense force, the chief of the Mossad. I mean, he talked to everybody over there. And when he got back, and of course we talked, he said that exactly what you said. And I said, well, how in the world is Israel going to get their jets over into Iran? And he said that both Egypt and Saudi Arabia have given the Israelis permission to do it. And certainly, Avi Lipkin told me exactly the same thing. So it's confirming what you're just saying. Yeah. Everything is in place, William, for an attack on Iran. Totally irrational, because if Israel attacks Iran, America is going to get drawn into that war. That's why I think this whole break between Israel and Washington D.C. is as phony as a $3 bill. And the Barack Obama is going to be able to say, "Well, we told them not to do it. Oh, they shouldn't have done it." But Iran sank one of our battleships or killed some of our people. American blood has been shed, and to remedy the shedding of American blood, we'll kill a lot more American boys. We'll be right back. Yeah, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, William is just talking about a recent article that appeared suggesting that Saudi Arabia has given Israel the green light to go ahead and attack Iran. Most people don't understand that the Saudis hate the Iranians because the Saudis are Sunnis, the Iranians are Shias, and the Shias are constantly trying to overthrow the Saudi regime. If they do, they'll lop off the heads of the Saudi king. So they just as soon have Israel attack Iran. They don't want to do it themselves. They'll get the Israelis to do it, and of course, if that happens, I think there are going to be terrible consequences. I have several other sources that tell the same story. Avi Lipkin told basically that same story. Certainly, Jerome Corsi of Dr. Corsi of World Net Daily told me essentially the same story. So this certainly just verifies what William is saying. Everything is in place for an Israeli strike on Iran, and we're not talking about, you know, next year or the year after that. We're talking about in the very, very near future. And this is frightening because, as William points out, this will, of course, cut off the oil to Europe and, of course, tank the European economy, could very well tank our economy. Go right ahead, William. I'd like your thoughts.
Yeah, I don't see how it could miss in terms of being a kill shot for what remains of the European economy right now. And quite frankly, if you take a look at where we're standing, just in this last week, we saw headlines that really should freeze the blood of anybody who's a sentient being. I believe it was Monday or Tuesday, there was a headline to the effect that prior to the next presidential election, the total indebtedness of the United States government, the debt, is going to exceed the gross national product of the United States. And then we saw another headline projecting something along the lines of a $19,600,000,000,000. I mean, the gross domestic product is between 12 and 13 trillion. The next rollout figure was almost $20 trillion of debt by 2012. I think those are lowball estimates because those are based on revenue projections, I think, that are completely irrational. Last week, you and I discussed the fact, Dr. Stan, that there were supposedly 41,000 private sector jobs created last month, when actually private sector job creation was in the negative range, whereas the 411,000 or 431,000 government sector jobs that were created were all basically make-work temporary jobs associated with the census. And the thing about the census figures we're learning is that the same bureau of the government that's in charge of conducting an accurate enumeration of the population is gaming the numbers with respect to its own employment ranks. There was a remarkable piece in the New York Post by a woman, if my memory serves, named Naomi Cohn, who was a census employee who was hired a couple of months ago. She wouldn't take offense if I pointed out that it's a misnomer to call her a census worker, because what she did in exchange for her taxpayer-funded paycheck was by no means work. She's the first to admit it. She talks about the fact that the Census Bureau hired and fired her several times in quick succession, and on every occasion they did this, they counted a new job created every time they rehired her. They just arbitrarily hired and fired her. And then they use these rehirings to goose the numbers that they're reporting in terms of their job productivity. And then she points out that they're overhiring, they're overstaffing, and they're overtraining people. She mentioned that the project that she was hired to carry out on behalf of the Census Bureau called for no more than 17 people, but there were 80 people assigned to it, which of course is, you know, more than a 400% overage for personnel versus the task that was assigned to be carried out. She mentioned the fact that on one occasion she was required to go and count people who were in a soup kitchen by way of trying to carry out a direct enumeration of that segment of the population in New York City. Well, this is something that could have been done very easily by any one census employee, perhaps two or three if you wanted to have redundancy. They sent 20 employees to do this. And once again, these are people who are hired and then fired, and then every time they're rehired, there's a job there's a created job that is tabulated by the Census Bureau. And the other thing that's really interesting here is that the Labor Department counts as a newly created job any position that involves 1 hour of compensated work for a month. Now, that's the rot behind the employment figures in our economy as things stand right now. It's not difficult to guess what direction our economy would go and how quickly it would get there if we ended up with a war against Iran that shut down the oil deliveries out of the Gulf region, which is exactly what a war against Iran would do. You don't have to have that in conjunction with the catastrophic spill in the Gulf of Mexico in order for it to drive the economy into oblivion, but the fact that we're still dealing with the BP spill in the Gulf, and this, of course, is another very large and fertile subject of discussion here in terms of the persistent and oddly conspicuous ineptitude of the part of the federal government here, for instance, turning away the offer by Royal Dutch Shell, which had ships in the region that could have been used to contain this spill very quickly and to start mitigating the damage weeks ago. And, of course, they were stiff-armed by the Obama administration, which seems to be acting on the assumption that not only should they not let a good crisis go to waste, they should do everything they could to turn a problem into a catastrophe, the better to make it exploitable. But this is the sort of thing that's, of course, re-energizing the demand for cap and trade, and that would be another way to tear down the energy-based economy of the United States. But if any combination of what we're discussing right now comes to fruition, if you're talking about the continued degradation of the American economy just through natural attrition, government spending and out-of-control inflation of the money supply taking its toll through attrition of the economy would be enough to drive us deeply, irremediably into economic destitution just all by itself. You couple that with the outgrowth of this exacerbated, if not manufactured, crisis of the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. I'm not trying to say that they sabotaged the oil site. I'm saying that in terms of what happened in the immediate aftermath, it seems as if they deliberately exacerbated the problem. I mean, that would be a more charitable explanation than to say that we're dealing with the incorrigible stupidity, I think. But those two factors together, without the intervention of a war in Iran, would be enough to result in apocalyptic economic hardship. But if you end up with, as I suspect and you suspect as well, a war against Iran, that's something that's going to tank the economy in Europe. That's something that's going to tank the economy in the United States. And the outgrowth here of these developments, any way you run the math, seems to me to be something on the order of the Great Depression cubed, you know, coupled with the other coefficient here, which is the growing and ever fortifying police state here in the United States. There's a really good example of how this works in microcosm that I was discussing with a friend of mine yesterday in Alabama, which is a state that is in dire economic straits, one of the most destitute states in the Deep South, which is really hurting right now. The economy has gotten so bad in Alabama because, in large measure, because of two things that have happened recently. The Pilgrim's Pride poultry processing company was lured into taking out huge loans earlier in this decade through this same package of blandishments that Wall Street has been using to give people involved in mortgages that they couldn't afford. And so they ended up getting over-leveraged to the point where it was completely unsustainable. And as a result, they were driven into a very favorable, at least to the people running Pilgrim's Pride, the corporate elite in Pilgrim's Pride, they were run into bankruptcy on very favorable terms. They ended up selling off Pilgrim's Pride to a Brazilian food packing giant. But the corporate elite had, by way of trying to pay off these improvident loans that they had made, they began to cut hours, and they began to require overtime, just huge amounts of overtime with no extra compensation. They began to wring this out of the employees, and they started to cut back on the labor force. Pretty soon, they started to shut down plants in some of these small towns in Alabama. And as a result, you have all these people who have high school educations and who were in company towns that have been run by Pilgrim's Pride that no longer have a place to find work. And at the same time, there's a major and very scandalous bankruptcy there in the capital city in Alabama, where the municipal government had succumbed to the song and dance from Wall Street in restructuring their debt to run their municipal water and sewer systems, and they ended up being led carefully into bankruptcy as well by the same bunco artists who'd brought about the bankruptcy of Pilgrim's Pride. So you've got all this archipelago of towns in Alabama where people basically are out of work. They have no prospects. They have no way of surmounting their immediate economic circumstances. And in a way, I think that's sort of a foreshadowing of some of the economic conditions that are going to be flourishing across the length and breadth of the United States over the next several years, unfortunately. Well, last May, I believe it was last May, I think it was last March, forgive me, there was a horrible mass murder carried out by a man named Michael McClendon in Sampson, Alabama, and he killed his mother and I believe his sister and I think eight other people before shooting and killing himself. And he was somebody who had been caught in the undertow of the bankruptcy of Pilgrim's Pride. His mother had worked for Pilgrim's Pride, and she had just lost her job. And she was being accused of overstating her hours, when actually what happened is that she was writing down her hours that had been tabulated before the new system went into effect as an austerity measure to pay off these bad loans that the corporate leaders, the corporate decision makers of Pilgrim's Pride had gotten into. And so he, as Gerald Celente said, fit the description of somebody who had lost everything and had nothing left to lose, and he lost it. And he ends up shooting and killing all these people, including himself, which is a horrible and inexcusable thing. It's a terrible crime. I'm not trying to say that the circumstances that he dealt with in any way justify what he did or mitigate the evil of it. The real story is in the aftermath here. While the shooting was going on, the police were, of course, conducting a manhunt for this guy who'd killed 10 people. And as is always the case, the police got to him after he had ended the engagement on his own terms. They were there to draw the chalk outlines and string up the crime scene tape. One of the reasons why people shouldn't count on the police to protect them, you should be armed and be capable of protecting yourself. But while this is going on, the local military base, Fort Rucker, dispatched soldiers to take part in the manhunt and to conduct checkpoints and roadblocks and to go house to house looking for this guy. They did this without an invitation from the local police. Sua sponte, on their own supposed authority, they began to exercise a police function in not only Sampson, but several other small towns that are surrounding it. These are all, once again, towns that have been very dependent on Pilgrim's Pride for their economy. And in the aftermath, there was an item that was published, sort of buried, an Associated Press item, that reported the following. An Army investigation found that soldiers should not have been sent to man traffic stops in a small Alabama town after 11 people were killed in March during a shooting spree. An Army report released to the Associated Press on Monday in response to a Freedom of Information Act request said that the decision to dispatch military police to Sampson from nearby Fort Rucker broke the law, but an Army spokesman said no charges had been filed following the August 10th report. The report from the Department of Army Inspector General found that the use of military personnel in Sampson violated the Posse Comitatus Act, which prohibits federal troops from performing law enforcement actions. The names of those involved were redacted from the report. According to the report, the officer's, quote, intent was to be a good Army neighbor and to help local civilian authorities facing a difficult, unique tragedy affecting the local community. There were no apparent adverse collateral effects to the support provided. Well, that's all well and good, except for the fact that it's against the law, and they should have known so. Now, it may have been a different thing if you're dealing with National Guard troops that were mobilized by the governor of the state under his authority as the commander-in-chief, the civilian what they would call the command authority, calling up the National Guard and seconding them under the supervision and under the authority of the local sheriff the sheriff being the posse comitatus, the apex law enforcement or peace officer authority in the county, that would have been a different thing. But this is a case where the U.S. Army, not the U.S. Army National Guard, which admittedly is a bit of a paper distinction, the U.S. Army simply decided on its supposed authority on its own initiative to get involved in this. And there are no prosecutions that will ensue. Well, later on in Jefferson County, a couple of months later, you're dealing with these constricting revenue flows. You're dealing with a collapsing local economy. Things had gotten so parlous that schools were being required to cut back on extracurricular activities. That's the sort of thing, incidentally, that's going on here in Idaho. Here in Idaho, there's a discussion now of high schools going to what they call a pay-for-play system regarding sports. In other words, they're no longer going to be paying for sports. You're going to have to be paying the expenses as boosters, as parents, as participants, in order to pay for transportation costs and perhaps even the insurance that would be involved in carrying out these sports that are not considered profitable. Football can pay for itself. Basketball usually can, maybe volleyball. But if you're a wrestler, if you're involved in track and field, if you're in the baseball or softball program, chances are you're going to be hit up to pay your own expenses. That's the same kind of thing that was going on in Alabama, but it was much worse. Well, what happened is that in Jefferson County, as the revenue streams were constricting, suddenly the sheriff found himself unable to be taking care of the territory that was assigned to him, and it was the largest county in the state of Alabama. And so what he said, essentially, is if we don't end up getting our budget through, what's going to happen is I'm going to have to lay off almost my entire force of deputies, and then we're going to have to call in the National Guard. That's something that is still under discussion right now in that county in Arkansas. But what I'm seeing happening, Dr. Stanton, and this is something I've talked about for a long time here, is that there are plans and programs in place right now to have the National Guard become the law enforcement, the internal security force within the United States, and any combination of these economic circumstances we're talking about could result in a systemic catastrophe of a sort that will result in the scenario Congressman Brad, I believe it was Brad Sherman, talked about in 2008, where there would be troops on the streets and martial law. That's a very real possibility. If we see the attack on Iran, that's the sort of that could be the next shoe to drop.
Now, who is it who wrote the article about Saudi Arabia giving a right of way?
It's in tomorrow's Times of London.
Times of London.
Yep.
Well, I haven't read tomorrow's Times of London yet. Our guest, of course, has been William Craig. Always a pleasure having him with us. We'll be right back. William, go right ahead, and when we get our listeners back, why I'm going to have you put out your information.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your two-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
Well, I was horrified when I saw the plight of the people in Haiti after the earthquake, but a similar event could happen right here in the United States, and that's why you should call the freeze-dry guy at 866-404-FOOD, that's 866-404-FOOD, and purchase a supply of his products. Freeze-drying is a great way to preserve food. I know because I bought a supply 40 years ago, and when I opened a can recently, the food was as fresh and tasty as when I purchased it. We're living in uncertain times, so if you'd like to have a supply of ground beef, diced beef, chicken, vegetables, or fruit on hand,
Call the freeze-dry guy at 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-FOOD. And mention you heard about him right here at Radio Liberty.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. And Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. And there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com. 1-800-SPECIAL.